Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, in a divided nation seeing record financial inequality, does organized labor offer a solution? We talked to a Florida native and longtime labor reporter about the power of union solidarity. Later in the program, First Coast meteorologist Tim Deegan joins us to discuss how the first major hurricane of the year portends a busy season ahead. But first, Hamilton Nolan's initial foray into organized labor was when he unionized Gawker. It was the first digital-only news site to unionize, and it sparked a wave of labor organizing across the media industry. He's out now with a new book. It's called The Hammer: Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. Welcome, Hamilton.
Thanks for having me.
It is so nice to have you here. So I want to start by talking about the Gawker organization effort, because it was really radical when it happened. It happened very, very quickly.
It happened in 2015 at a time when the online media was really booming. It was the hot new industry replacing the old print media that was dying out to some degree. And the print media industry was unionized for many, many decades, and the online media didn't have any unions. And so there was a little bit of conventional wisdom that this new online media was different, and there was different technology and different culture for young workers. But in reality, nobody had really tried to organize it. And so the Writers Guild of America East, which was a union that was traditionally a screenwriters union, decided to try to organize in the online media industry, and we at Gawker were the first ones, and we did. We successfully unionized in about 6 weeks. So it kind of taught me that instead of saying things can't be done, just go ahead and try it, and you might be surprised.
Yeah. Did it give you any false sense of a false sense of what could be done and how quickly? I mean, 6 weeks is a pretty short runway.
It was a short runway. I mean, it was definitely not a traditional union campaign, but I think it actually gave me a better sense of the possibilities of what could be done. And it sort of set me down the path as a labor reporter of seeing some of the ways that organized labor was not taking advantage of the bigger possibilities that were out there in society.
Tell us a little bit about what it means to be a labor reporter. I've seen you say that it's kind of business reporting, but, you know, told for the perspective of ordinary people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's funny because every newspaper and every publication has a business section. Their entire, you know, the Wall Street Journal is a business newspaper. It's considered very normal by people to read news from the perspective of business. And when you think about it, labor reporting, you know, a good way to think about it is just business reporting from the perspective of human beings. So most people who are reading the news are never going to be CEOs. They're never going to be private equity titans, but almost all of them are workers, and almost all of us are part of labor. And so labor reporting is just talking about work and from the perspective of people.
Yeah. That's really, how does that change the story that you tell, do you find?
I think it's a much more human story. It's a story about how people try to live in this world, the struggles that people go through, what it takes to, you know, successfully make it in American society. And it's a much more familiar story, I think, to most people who are going to read it. Again, like, most people do not participate in the business world from the perspective of a business or of a millionaire investor. Most of us work for a living. Most of us are workers, and labor is about what we all do to survive and how we could collectively live better in this society.
I'm guessing you would think it's no accident that the way we do report on business is primarily from a business perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, one of the downsides of labor reporting is it doesn't attract a lot of money and advertising, obviously, because the advertising comes from businesses, and businesses like to see coverage from the perspective of business. So labor reporting, not a lucrative field, but, you know, if you look back earlier in the 20th century, in American newspapers, it was very, very common for big newspapers to have full-time labor reporters on staff. And it was partly not just because the newspapers themselves had more money, but also because labor, organized labor at that time in America, was much more prominent and powerful. And so as organized labor itself declined, the coverage of it has also declined a little bit.
Tell us about your path to understanding labor and its significance. I think that you said in your book that it was kind of like having the veil lifted. You understood economic inequality in a whole new way.
Yeah, you know, when I got into journalism, I didn't get into journalism to become a labor reporter. I just got into journalism to kind of be like, why is America broken? You know, why do the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? Why are there homeless people on the streets and rich people in the penthouse? And common questions, you know, that some of which I wrote about for you at Folio Weekly when I was first starting out in journalism. And I found over the years as I reported on those kind of basic questions about society, I kept over and over coming back to issues of labor and coming back to issues of worker power and the decline of worker power, you know, and the answers to a lot of those questions that I had ended up being rooted in labor issues. And so over the years, I just became more and more of a labor reporter because I found that labor issues were at the heart of those biggest questions about American society.
You know, you mentioned Folio. You and I did work together at Folio. I remember at the time, you know, you were covering politics and zoning issues, mm-hmm. and you had expressed, you know, ideally what you would like to do in journalism, you know, maybe a satirist, kind of in the vein of PJ O'Rourke. And I sort of said, like, good luck with that, you know. And then, you know, a couple of years later, you're at Gawker and you're kind of leading this new online media empire. You're really, you know, doing everything that you wanted to do in that space.
Yeah, that dream did get to come true a little bit. You know, I was never that serious of a reporter. I mean, I like the aspect of journalism that always appealed to me was it's sort of a way to get the bad guys. It's sort of a way to tell the truth. You know, it's a way to yell about the inequities in society, and you know, to even the playing field between regular people and powerful institutions. And so I was less interested in, you know, working at the New York Times than I was at being able to, like, make fun of the New York Times. And so Folio was a great place for that in Jacksonville, and Gawker was a place for that nationally.
So one of the focuses of your book, The Hammer, is the failure of big organized labor to fulfill what you think is its mission and really what it needs to survive and to grow.
Yeah, I mean, for context, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, at the height of union power in America after World War II, 1 in 3 workers in America was a union member. And today the figure is 1 in 10. So that is the scale of the decline over the second half of the 20th century up to now of unions and organized labor. And a lot of that is because they've been attacked, of course, by business interests and by political interests. But part of the reason is also that big unions and organized labor's own institutions have kind of failed to rise to the occasion. They have failed to really compete in that battle with business interests over that time period. And they don't invest enough money in organizing new workers. And so I hope, you know, if one thing that they can maybe take out of my book is just that we need to energize ourselves and we need to spend a lot of money to organize millions of new workers into the labor movement.
You talk about the decline of representation or the density of labor in the workforce today. And that sort of tracks with the disparities in income as well, like from the middle of last century to today.
Yeah, there's a very famous chart, actually, that shows one line is the decline of union density, which union density is just a term that means the portion of the workforce that's unionized. And that line goes straight down. And then for the same time period, the line of economic inequality and the amount of wealth that goes to the very rich goes straight up. And it's very easy to see the direct relationship between those two measurements. So as organized labor has gotten weaker over the second half of the 20th century, workers have gotten less bargaining power. They're not able to negotiate as good wages and working conditions. And in that power vacuum, the, you know, business gets stronger and they've been able to retain more of the profits for themselves and the rich have gotten richer. So, you know, that decline of organized labor power is really key to the entire rise of economic inequality that's kind of characterized my entire lifetime in America.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the state of and the potential power of unionized labor. If you are part of a union or you're interested in starting one, you can call us on air at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. We've got a call from Eric in Arlington. Good morning, Eric. Go ahead.
Good morning. 2 points real quick. I think one reason that we kind of fall into this trap of paying so much attention to or paying such little attention to labor is that, you know, in this country, there's this sort of myth, this narrative that individuals shape, you know, history in the world, and, you know, Edison and George Washington and all the rest of it. But the truth is that we are all hopelessly, and I mean hopelessly, interdependent on one another. I mean, you getting, you know, meat in the cooler at Publix, there's probably 15,000 people involved in that process. And so it's a myth that this thing of the individual is so important and the group isn't. That's problematic because it's a very strong myth in America. We see it right now with the election, with the presidential election. And my question is, in 1974, that was the point at which Americans had their highest standard of living. And there's another famous graph that shows that from 1974 on, it's basically standard of living is either stagnant or drops. And the 1% of wealth goes up astronomically. I mean, the two things are so related, it's ridiculous to think that they're not. Why aren't people, the biggest question in the election, this is my question for you, the biggest question in this presidential election should be, why aren't we taxing billionaires and corporations anymore? But nobody, I mean, nobody in the media, or, I mean, you hear a little blurbs here and there, but this is the biggest thing. Should the IRS have their funding restored where they can, you know, go after tax cheats?
Thanks, Eric. I'm just going to wrap it there. But I mean, he raises a really good point in terms of taxing, and it has changed. You've, I believe, reported about, you know, the tax rate for millionaires, mm-hmm. People at the kind of top of the income food chain that you know, in the mid-century was around 93%, the marginal tax rate, the top marginal tax rate. Today it's 37%.
Yeah.
So there was a time when people who were making extraordinary amounts of money were really taxed kind of back into a more
right. And all of this stuff goes together, right? I mean, the attack on organized labor and its power, not only did it hurt working people by not having unions, but it saps the political power of organized labor, which allows business interests to become more politically powerful and push down their tax rates and things like that, you know. And you know, the point that the caller made about the 70s being kind of the peak of shared prosperity in America, you know, that was after 30 years of organized labor being very, very strong in the post-World War II generation. So, you know, the golden age, ironically, the golden age in America that a lot of even Republicans like to harken back to and be like, this is when times were good, you know, in the 50s and 60s, that was produced by unions, and that was produced by the strength of labor to share the prosperity among all people. And what we have today is still a ton of wealth in America, but very much worse distribution of that wealth.
Well, his point was, why don't we hear about this more? Why do you think we don't hear more about, you know, raising taxes or, you know, taxing billionaires? Why isn't that more of a discussion?
You know, it is to some extent. I mean, you look at the Bernie Sanders, the rise of Bernie Sanders politically, you know, he was considered a marginal figure, and he became a serious presidential contender on the back of that issue. So he did. He was a person who was able to tap into that issue and kind of spread the word about that issue. I think that a lot of Americans are generally dissatisfied with the world that economic inequality has produced, that we're all living in. But everybody is not very sure about the diagnosis of what exactly went wrong and how to fix it. And so I absolutely agree. You know, we need to spread that message of inequality that the Bernie Sanders campaign spread, and spread it more widely and educate people about how we got here in the first place.
You have less faith, though, in politicians changing tax laws than you do in the labor movement to restore some measure of equality.
Right. I mean, when you think about how to fix economic inequality, there's really only two ways. A, the government can do it. They can tax the rich and they can build a social safety net and funnel money to the poor. And of course, the government failing to do that for 50 years is how we got here in the first place. So I'm not that optimistic about that happening anytime soon. But the only other way to fix it is for working people to regain enough power to get their fair share of the wealth in this country. And the tool for doing that is labor unions and the labor movement.
So a lot of us, people my age anyway, think of the kind of death knell of labor in this country was when President Ronald Reagan fired the air traffic controllers who were striking in 1981. that was seen as kind of a radical departure from what was done and what was acceptable. But of late, there's been something of a resurgence. You know, we see Starbucks, the auto industry's had some big wins, Hollywood, yeah. Media.
Yeah, absolutely true. You know, and people who worked in the labor movement during that time when PATCO happened and Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers, you know, will say it really struck a lot of fear in the labor movement itself. And it took them decades to kind of recover from that. But you are seeing now, I think, a very real resurgence. Public opinion polls say unions are more popular than they've been in 60 years in America. And part of that, you know, is the huge inequality. And another part of that is, I think, the pandemic and people living through the experience of the pandemic and seeing that they did not have a safety net when that emergency happened, and seeing that the people who were called essential workers did not come out of that with permanent gains for the risk that they took. And so really millions of people had kind of a radicalizing experience going through the pandemic and saying, hey, we need something better here in the workplace. And so, yeah, you have seen a lot of new energy and excitement in the labor movement since then.
You also see, though, the pandemic is a missed opportunity when it comes to what big labor could have or should have done. In particular, you talk about frontline workers like grocery store workers who you think, you know, should have been able to basically demand whatever they wanted at that period, and they would have been able to get it.
Right. I mean, you know, the job of a union is to use available leverage to help working people and help improve their lives. And if you think about the early days of the pandemic, when there were very high risks and we were asking people to risk their lives to really keep society running, including grocery workers, you know, if grocery workers who were unionized at that time had said, hey, we all want $10 an hour raises, they would have got it, because society would have shut down if those people did not go to work and take that risk to keep the doors open. And that was, it really was a big missed opportunity. And it kind of illustrates a bit of the lack of vision that you see at the top of organized labor to look at the big picture and say, where can we really, really use our points of leverage to help working people nationally?
If you have questions about organized labor or you have questions for Hamilton Nolan, you can call us at 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. So in your book, Hamilton, you go to various places around the country and sort of tell the stories of these places as they tried to unionize, some successfully, some not. One relevant experience, you know, happened in South Carolina. Was at a Starbucks,
mm-hmm.
Where they did manage to unionize. Explain why you think they were successful in a very anti-union state in the first place.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a chapter in the book about South Carolina, because South Carolina is the state with the lowest union density in the United States of America. It's the most anti-union state in the whole country, the hardest place for unions to operate. And while I was there reporting that chapter, the Starbucks campaign did successfully unionize some stores in that state. And it was interesting, because an advantage that the Starbucks campaign had is that they were a national campaign and the workers were thinking on a national scale. They were thinking about this entire company nationally. So those workers who successfully pulled off those union drives weren't sitting there in South Carolina saying, it's so hard to unionize in South Carolina. You know, they had their eyes on the prize of the entire company of Starbucks, and they were seeing successful Starbucks union drives all across the country, and they said, there's no reason why we can't be a part of this big national campaign. And so I think, again, looking at the big picture, plugging into the big picture, workers seeing themselves as part of a larger movement that spans the whole country can give people not only the resources but the inspiration to do things like those Starbucks workers did in South Carolina.
And yet, as you say, South Carolina has been very difficult for unions to organize in. Explain some of the landscape there that makes it so challenging.
Yeah, and this is true in South Carolina, but it's also true in Florida and really true throughout the South in particular. Every state in the South is what's called right to work, which means that unions cannot require people to pay dues. Even if a union represents a workplace and negotiates a contract for you, they can't require you to pay dues. And so it just hurts unions' ability to maintain themselves and stay financially viable. On top of that, South Carolina and every other southern state is extremely politically hostile to unions. You can see what Ron DeSantis is doing in Florida right now, passing very, very hostile laws to labor. And that's true of almost every Southern Republican governor. They see themselves as people whose job it is to make the landscape friendly to big corporations. And part of their vision for that is making the landscape hostile to worker power and worker organizing. And that happens all over the South.
And that happens at the highest levels. As you say, Nikki Haley has kind of publicly said that that state had no interest in unionizing because they didn't want to, quote, taint the water.
Yeah, it's really a little bit sick, because if you think about it, these Southern governors like Nikki Haley and like the governor of Tennessee and many other Southern governors, you know, will get up and give press conferences and say, we don't want a union here. For example, when the United Auto Workers right now are trying to unionize auto factories down south. And what the governor is basically saying is, I see myself as working more for an international corporation, Mercedes-Benz, than I see for working for my own constituents who live in my state and work in my state. You know, and if you think about it that way, it's a really, really twisted and backwards way to think about representing the people of your state.
We've got a call from Bob in St. Augustine. Good morning, Bob. Go ahead.
Good morning, Hamilton. It's Bob Adams.
Hey, Bob.
Hey. It's ironic that I'd be calling you to discuss something I'd like to discuss with you last night. But I wanted to talk about my experience as a union member back just prior to the PATCO debacle. On the level of the local, I always found it was, first of all, there was a lot of schadenfreude amongst the union members at the time of PATCO, because PATCO was a white-collar organization. And it's like the local members couldn't take it in that this was such a bad indication for labor as a whole. And my experience as a union member at that time, I was appalled at the racism on the local level, where, you know, I would go to meetings of the local and there's a whole lot of discussion about how to keep blacks out of the local. I wanted to just get your thoughts about how to address that, you know, as we move forward as a stronger and more progressive labor movement.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, well, it's very true, you know, that organized labor itself has a long history of racism and many other flaws, like many other institutions in American society do. And you know, it's always the work of unions to constantly police themselves and be better. You know, and the nature of a union is that everybody in a workplace is in the union. So it's not you picking your five favorite people, you know, it's everybody's in. And so there's going to be arguments, there's going to be disagreements, there's going to be political disagreements, you know. But I think what I really focus on is, like, the institutional role of unions in America is to make this country a more equal place, a more fair place. And that is what they do in the big picture. And for everybody out there who is a union member, you know, and I'm a union member too, it's our individual responsibilities to constantly, within our own unions, kind of police our own unions and try to push our own unions in the right direction. But over time, unions will push the whole country in the direction of more equality.
In your book, you talk about a variety of examples of people who've been really passionate and moving this union effort ahead. And you talk about the need for people who are in unions, as you say, to continue to advocate, to continue to recruit, and to fight. You say that, you know, fighting is really foundational to keeping and sustaining a union. But I mean, you're a fighter yourself, right? You were kind of a combative writer, but you also are a boxer.
Yeah.
It may not be everybody's interest in a fight, a long, lifelong fight.
You know, it's true. And I remember when we were first organizing unions in my own industry, when, you know, people have a lot of fear when you first start to organize, and they would say, you know, are we going to have to go on strike one day? And when we first started, I would say, no, definitely not. Don't worry about it. And then, you know, a few years down the road, guess what? It's time to go on strike. And so I wish I hadn't said that in the first place. So I try to be honest about the fact that, you know, look, when I say we all have to fight, what I really mean is we all have to stand up for ourselves. You know, nobody is going to help you as a working person except for yourself and your coworkers and the power that you have of being in solidarity with your coworkers. So none of us want to be in a fight, especially not at work, but we all have to stand up for ourselves or you end up getting stepped on. So everybody has to have some point when you say, I will stand up for myself and represent my own interests.
One of the extraordinary stories in your book is the effort in California to unionize childcare workers, which you can't really think of a more disparate, you know, less organized bunch of people. I mean, this is not people who are working in daycares. This is in-home caregivers.
Yeah, it was such a great example of like what can be done in the labor movement. This was a 20-year-long campaign to organize 40,000 separate child care providers in California. And as you said, these are people who take care of mostly low-income kids in their own homes. So they weren't connected to each other. They didn't all go to the same workplace. You know, multiple unions had to spend literally decades going out throughout the entire state of California and organizing this huge group of mostly women, many, many immigrants, you know. And at the same time, they had to get the state law changed in California because at that time, the law in California wouldn't have allowed that group of workers to collectively bargain. So a 20-year-long campaign, I spoke to women whose moms were there at the beginning of the campaign, and the mom retired, and the daughter went into the business, and the daughter was there at the end of the campaign, you know. But it really is such a great story of sticking with it and having a big picture view. And ultimately, they did succeed, and they now have a union contract.
We've got a call from Susan in St. John's. Good morning, Susan. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for allowing me to talk on the radio. I just appreciate these kind of conversations so much. And I just want to address the prior caller who asked about racism in the union, because your answer was perfect. It was honest. It was open. But we still need more work to do now about what happened then. And without our admitting the problems and the hindrance that made to people, and especially I experienced some conversations in Kansas City in the 90s where the union did not want to admit that there was any racism.
Susan.
And the workers did not want to admit that. And yet, when you look at the numbers, Blacks were not welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Susan Hamilton.
Yeah, you know, again, it's very true. And a union is a democracy, right? A union is a little democracy in itself. And so the same way that you have to fight within society in our democracy in America to, for example, fight against racism and make governments better and make local governments better and state governments better, you also have to work within the union to make your union better, you know, and there is a very, very rich and deep history of racism within the labor movement that went alongside racism within society as a whole, you know, and a lot of what I write about today is unions that I think should be doing things differently, you know, but the important thing is to get in the game in the first place by getting involved in a union and being able to push them in the right direction.
We've got a call from John in Riverside, who is a union member. Good morning, John. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm third generation union. I'm a gay man who's been out since the early 70s. And I want to say that the Communication Workers of America was protecting me in the 70s. I realize there is racism in there, but my experience with the communication, I worked for Bell South, was that that they did protect me. Also, there was racism at Bell South. But the Black people joined the union and they worked their way into positions of power. My message to my fellow gay people, now that we're facing backlash, like with the Bud Light thing or Target being cowered into reducing their gay Pride Month displays, is vote union and then work to get into positions of power. My grandfather was one of the organizers of the Bond Bread Company. He would come home where the cops had beaten him with billy clubs. My grandmother would take out a straight razor, shave around the opening things on his head, sew them up, and he went back on the line. This is not going to be easy, but it has to be done. The idea that 30,000 Amazon employees are on food stamps and Medicaid while Jeff Bezos has a fantasy spaceship and pays no taxes is the problem we have right now. This is as serious fight as any other one you're going to face politically.
John, thanks so much. It's a remarkable story, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And shout out to CWA, strong union, even down south. I mean, look, you know, what I took from that story, and I think you made the point very well, is like a union is a tool. You know, what a union does is to give power to you as the workers, and then you can take that and use it for whatever you need to use it for. If you're getting discrimination in the workplace because you're gay, the union can be your tool to fight that. If you're getting racism in the workplace, the union can be your tool to fight that. You know, the union is a tool that you can use for whatever you need it for. And fundamentally, if you don't have it, you don't have that power. If you do have it, you do have that power. And you, as the workers, can decide how you need to use it.
So for people who are interested in unionizing, I mean, a lot of people really just don't know where to start or who, you know, who to call, how that would even begin.
Yeah, it's actually a big problem. And I always tell people there's a great group called EWOC, E-W-O-C, the Emergency Workers Organizing Committee, which you can look up and contact online. They will put you in touch with a union organizer. The AFL-CIO's website, you can connect with the union organizer. Those are two easy ways. Or talk to a union member you know, and ask them to put you in touch. Or you can look me up and contact me, and I'll put you in touch with somebody. But I wish that we had a better infrastructure for getting people in touch with organizers. But if you do just a little bit of Googling, you can find that connection.
Well, Hamilton Nolan, he's the author of The Hammer, Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. He's also the publisher of the How Things Work Substack. Hamilton, it's great to see you again. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. That was fun.
Up next, First Coast meteorologist Tim Deegan takes your questions as we buckle up and batten down for the season ahead. Welcome back. From Beryl, Chris, and Debbie, all the way to William, these are some of the name storms that are likely going to be on our radar this year. Joining me to talk about it, my friend and First Coast News meteorologist, Chief Meteorologist Tim Deegan. Hey, Tim.
What does that mean anyhow?
Which part of it?
The chief.
Oh, well.
I've never quite understood.
You run the show.
It's, what's that?
You run the show. You run the whole operation over there.
No, let's be honest. Since you actually know how it works, you know I don't run the show. Good to see you.
It's good to see you,
too. I mean, I've been listening to you, so your voice sounds healthy, but you look healthy.
You look great. It's really nice to see your face.
I suspect the listeners are helping you stay healthy, so appreciate that.
They're keeping me on my toes.
Good. Yeah. Good.
And the weather, no doubt, is keeping you on yours.
It's, you know, it's never a given. It's not boring.
No. So this storm that we saw go through, this is a million superlatives. It's the strongest Atlantic storm ever observed in July. It's the earliest Category 5 in history. How many of these superlatives are you issuing these days?
Well, you know, and I understand the laugh, and I used to laugh back in the 90s, but I do remember specifically saying on TV that look, no one particular meteorological event, storm, tornado, record heat, you name it, no one event in the 90s, in my opinion, was going to prove the greenhouse that humans were indeed showing the greenhouse theory works, even though I did believe that humans back then were changing the climate. But I also said back then, but if we go through the decades and this one event becomes 10, becomes 100, becomes 1,000, becomes 1,000,000, please, I hope people wake up. I guess the point I'm making is that even though Beryl was well forecast to become a hurricane, forget about major, that far to the east that early, and although we've been saying since the 90s, if we don't do something significant, our oceans are going to warm, and that's potential energy. And that just means sooner or later, that potential energy out of chaos will become something. Even though all of that intellectually has been in my head now for 30 years, my wife knows that I was humbled when I saw that. It really shook me to my bones, and I thought, why do I feel that way? If this was well forecast as this particular storm, we've been talking about it since the 90s. It just was another one of those times, in whatever you want to call the last 30 years, where we've been talking about the greenhouse gas crisis, the problem that us humans are causing. I don't mean it humbled me or caused me to tremble in that, oh, it's so terrible, other than that, well, here we are, you know? And so just to underline what you said. So we had never seen a hurricane that far to the east. And the reason is because although many of us may think of places east of Barbados as being warm and tropical and what's the big deal, no, because of the currents, because of upwelling coming off the coast of Africa, it's always been too cool this time of the year. It's just we've warmed up even the cool places to where they can produce a hurricane. But then we go beyond that, right? It was warm enough to produce a major hurricane. So it is shattering the record even a legitimate word? I mean, it would be beyond that. Then it gets into the Caribbean, and it becomes the second Cat 5 ever. Think about that in human history. And then when you look at it, you say, and it happened 2 weeks earlier than Emily, which was 2005.
And when you say the only Cat 5, you mean in the month of June or in that area?
By this time it was early July. But no, in the what we call, when we talk about the Atlantic Basin, that's the Atlantic, the Caribbean, and the Gulf. So whereas when it first became a hurricane and then a major, you would have to say we've never seen one that far to the east. There had been Audrey in 57 in the Gulf, and then I can't think of the storm Alma in 66 in the Caribbean, as far as a Category 3 hurricane.
But okay, when you said we've only seen two Cat 5s, what
in the Atlantic Basin?
Okay,
in our part of the world, is not exaggerating to say, and then to realize, oh my gosh, and of those two, and the first one was Emily, which was during what we consider to be the greenhouse era. That was 2005. And now the second one, so this is only the second, both have occurred in the last 19 years.
But we've had Cat 5s hit. You know, Michael was a Cat 5, right?
But not this early in the season.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's, I'm sorry. Yeah, so that's the point. Because normally the waters are too cool.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. That Cat 5s, yeah, there's been plenty of Cat 5s, more in the last 20 years than we've seen in the last 60. But yeah, you expect that in late August and September, but ocean temperatures are right now what they typically are in August and September.
As a meteorologist, the speed with which these storms are forming and transforming into something more intense seems like it's probably getting more challenging by the day.
Well, so to talk about the general science of meteorology, we don't know all the reasons. We know some. So I don't want to sound like we're clueless, but we've known for at least 45 to 50 years that the nightmare hurricanes, yes, are the Cat 4 and 5s, but it just so happens meteorologically, those are the ones you expect to rapidly intensify. So it's not so much that we have this new thing of rapid intensifiers. It's the fact that the waters are warm enough to allow a Cat 4 and 5 to form, and the very nature of what allows that to happen almost implies that if the ingredients are there for a 4 to 5 to form, the ingredient is probably there for it to be a rapid intensifier. They almost come with each other. But you can imagine whether you're a mayor, an emergency manager, or a forecaster, that's a nightmare, not only because it's so bad, but because you can't give people enough time to get out of harm's way.
I want to take a call from Joe in Atlantic Beach. Good morning, Joe. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. A great show. Given the immense impact of animal slaughter industry on the environment, our health, why are we not promoting a kind, healthy, and climate-friendly plant-based lifestyle? And I hope Mr. Deegan will request Mayor Deegan to sign the plant-based treaty to promote a plant-based lifestyle in our great city. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. I think I know exactly how Joe's smile looks because I think we've talked before. And here's what I will say is that if the word holistic means everything's connected and everything impacts it, us, you have a meteorologist and hopefully I'm not speaking too much for the mayor, but a mayor that that does think that we can't just solve problems like this piecemeal. It is all connected. So at the very least, I personally think what Joe says, some of that makes sense.
You were talking about, you know, for hurricanes, that rapid intensification can be known. But I'm thinking even of, you know, there was a tornado in Detroit recently that the National Weather Service couldn't even get out ahead of because it happened so quickly and without warning. And so those sort of challenges as a meteorologist seem like those are getting more difficult.
Well, yeah. And in a way, a tornado is a different animal. So I hear you. If you can wish for such things, even with rapid intensifiers, I'd still want a hurricane because at least you're talking on days of preparation mm-hmm. versus a tornado. Right. Sometimes you're right. Sometimes we can't verify what we're seeing on radar until we hear that the tornado hit. And then you combine it hitting in a place that far to the north and this early in the season. And as you know, as a communicator, for true communication to go on, people have to be listening. And my point is, if you're living in Detroit and it's May and some of the leaves have just come on, you're not even necessarily listening for a tornado warning, right? And so you're right. The whole, to me, that's another example of holistic, that that this is a big picture problem. You know, there was a book that was written back in 2005, 2006, and it was from who I think is a very well-respected scientist, and it was called The Storms of Our Grandchildren. And the point that I loved in the title wasn't just focused on heat, and it wasn't just focused on us right now, but it's focused on all of this stuff that you're talking about that impacts us in ways that if we really don't think about it, we're going to miss solving the problem. Just because some people are dealing with things they've never dealt. I thought about this morning. That yes, Jamaica's used to hurricanes. Jamaica has had major hurricanes. But for people who've lived there for generations, they've never looked at a hurricane, at a Cat 5 heading their way in early July. It hasn't been part of their, I think some historians know, you could go back to, I'm rambling too long, I know.
No, you're good.
Okay, well, historians who are out there know this, and that is that the Spanish, when they came to the Americas to get the gold, they knew that their ships laden with gold had to be leaving Cuba by about July in September or in August because things were going to get bad. Well, that wouldn't work necessarily now. They'd be too late.
Tim Deegan, it is a delight to have you on my show. I appreciate that you came by and I hope you come back soon during the season.
If you'll let me ramble on, I will come on.
100%. For sure. Okay. Anytime. And stick around, we'll be back in just a minute with some stories to shake off your summer doldrums.
Congaree & Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpenn.com.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
This July 4th, join me, Alfonso Rivero, as I'm back to host America's National Independence Day celebration, a Capital Four, with Smokey Robinson, Sheila E., Fantasia, Darren Criss, Chloe Flower, Fitz and the Tantrums, Lauren Allred, Sean Johnson East, Sister Sledge featuring Sledgendary, and the greatest live fireworks display in the USA. Live from the U.S. Capitol, it's a Capitol 4. Thursday, July 4th, 8, 7 Central, only on PBS.
Ransomware hackers are taking hospital medical information systems hostage, and it's costing massive amounts of money and risking lives.
I could literally go to the Pyxis, which is our medication dispensing machine, and pull out any medication I wanted. I almost hung the wrong medication.
Behind the sharp rise in healthcare cybercrime. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
School's out, summer's here. But for students whose college abruptly closed in the spring, this season is anything but relaxing. It's no secret that many institutions are struggling financially. New reporting says colleges are shutting down rapidly, at least one every week. What happens to students and faculty when their college closes? And why are so many of these institutions finding it difficult to stay open? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. Summertime is a great time for storytelling, whether it's a great beach read or ghost stories around the campfire. And summer is also the theme of the upcoming installment of Untold Stories at the Florida Theater. It's an event on July 11th. It brings an end to the series' third season. And here to tell us about it is artistic director and host, Barbara Colicello. Hey, Barb. Hey, Babs.
Hi. Babs or Barbara? good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined by one of the featured storytellers, Tony Ayupi. Thanks for being here, Tony.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, Babs, what is your favorite season? You've done winter, fall, winter, spring. Now we're summer.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the winter was very strong storytelling, but of course it was darker, I think, than some of the other ones, yeah, just because it's winter. And this one is, I love this summer one because it's very varied what people are talking about. Really different experiences. I have one storyteller who he just said, I give people inspiration, like triggers to think about. And he just said, my story, my summer story has nothing to do with anything that you would think of. My summers, there's no barbecues, et cetera, et cetera. So his story is very interesting and deep.
And so you pick themes. This year you kind of kept these themes loose. Do you think next season you're going to do more targeted, kind of prescribed
themes? Honestly, I right now don't have a clue. I've been so crazy with these shows. The minute this one is over, I will spend 2 weeks just focused on it. I get ideas. I'm reading a book and I read a phrase and I'm like, that's it. I got all four themes.
Do you like it, keeping it loose, though? Is it kind of easier for the storytellers, or is it easier to have a targeted one?
Yeah, I like picking something that is broad in the sense that you're not going to get two similar stories, but also enough of an interesting trigger. You need like a sieve to go through. Like if you just say to somebody, do you have a good story? It doesn't jar the memory, but when you say, like, my next storytelling thing at Babs Lab is framed. The theme is framed.
Fun.
Well, I expect all kinds of different stories, right? So it's hard finding six storytellers that with varied storytellers, blah, 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 blah. So I have to come up with good themes.
Yeah. And Tony, this is your first time as a storyteller on this stage doing the Untold Stories.
Yes.
You are actually a graphic artist, or I guess the term is sometimes a sequential artist.
Yes.
How is storytelling on stage different or similar to telling stories, sequential stories like a graphic novel?
So the way that I kind of think about it is all the art that I create revolves around story. And so what I do with my sequentials, where I'm writing the words and drawing the pictures, when I'm on stage, I'm using my whole body. So at this, when you come to Florida Theater, you'll hear the words, but you'll see me actually like moving and using my hands and gesturing. So I'll be able to gesture and move my body and just use that as part of my storytelling.
Do you find that you pace it in the same way as when you're drawing frame to frame?
It's actually pretty similar. So some story structures have like four parts, but I really love kind of building up the suspense and like have this big moment or epiphany and then like what happens after that. And so when I'm doing the storytelling, whether it's in comics or like telling a story in front of an audience, that's what I'm thinking about. How can I get you hooked? How can I reel you in and take you on a journey?
How are you preparing right now for the show on the 11th?
A lot of writing, a lot of voice recording, and a lot of editing. So I'm killing a lot of my darlings just to make everything so concise.
You mean you're taking out some of the parts that you're sort of committed to?
Some things I would have liked to put
this
in.
This morning, he was like, okay, to get it down, I have to take out this part. I'm like, oh,
because
maybe.
Is there a real strict time limit?
I'm trying to get, I'm stricter with this group because what's been happening, 10 to 12 minutes is perfect. But if I say 12, it's 14, 15.
Yep.
Yes.
And because we have the podcast.
With WJCT.
With WJCT.
Right.
I know David Luckin doesn't like if I have a 16, 17 minute story.
Right. So I have,
he is a hard man to
work
for.
You know.
I'm just kidding.
Like, so for me, it started 27, then it went to 24 to 17. So now I'm I think I got 12 minutes to hook you in.
That's fantastic. I mean, for people who aren't familiar with this, Babs, the idea is it's ordinary people telling stories, real true life stories. They're doing it without a script. They're doing it without a lectern. They're just on the stage naked in front of the, naked, but they're telling these.
But they will tell you they're naked.
Often very revealing stories.
Yes. Yes. I had a discussion the other day with someone who came to one of the storytellers and story events. And she said that, she didn't know if she was going to go back because she didn't find it entertaining. And I said, well, it depends on what you feel is entertaining. These evenings, the response, inspirational.
Oh.
Life is messy and you're going to hear a lot of, it's funny, it's messy, it's ironic, it's deep. And that's what we're bringing you, life and resilience.
Well, Barbara Colicello, Tony Iuppi, thank you so much for being here and have a great show. Break a leg.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our program. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock, or you can download or subscribe to our podcast on WJCT.org or your favorite podcast platform. The team is taking a few days off for the 4th of July holiday. The show resumes Monday when my colleague Dan Scanlon talks pensions and pay raises with Jacksonville Fire Rescue Chief Keith Powers. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.